You're listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations podcast from Los Angeles. I'm Edgar Montplaisir. I was the guest on a previous episode, but today I'm back as your host for another round of our ongoing La Ronde. Today, my guest is Dan Lippert, who improv fans might know from Big Grande and Winslow.
Yeah.
Hey, also Coach of DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Also the voice of, of Zorn?
The body of Zorn.
Yeah.
Not the voice of Zorn.
You're the voice of his body?
I'm the body of his voice. I played him live on set when they filmed the show, but Jason Sudeikis was the actual voice when they recorded it.
I understand.
Mm-hmm. I wish I was the voice.
That would be dope.
Yeah, I'd be super rich.
So I noticed something about us being paired as guests. I don't think ever there's been such a big discrepancy between experience in host and guest before.
Yeah.
And also, this is probably the deepest voices between host and guest as well.
That's true. People are going to have to pop the bass on their stereos for this one.
Pop the bass. So,
why did you say about experience? What's your experience level?
I've only been doing it for like maybe a year and a half.
Okay.
How long have you been doing it?
I took my first UCB class in 2010, I think.
Okay.
Or 2009. I've been on Winslow since 2011.
Yeah. So there you go. I took my first class July of 2015.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You skyrocketed.
Sure. So I had like this form that I wanted to like base the podcast off of, kind of, which like my idea was, I'm really interested in the idea of like roles on teams.
Okay.
Like what role you fit into and like who you are for that team, right? And stuff like that. So I wanted to like kind of go through like from the beginning of your improv career, like what team you were on, and you can kind of like talk about like that history and stuff like that, but then like what role you kind of felt like you fit into on that team, and like you know, like and in any sense of the word, like even as like if like, oh, I booked shows, or like, you know, like I kind of felt like I was really good at finding the game and highlighting it for people. So sure. In both senses of the word role.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think we'll have a very interesting conversation.
Yeah. So then what was your first improv team?
My very, very first improv team?
Yeah. So like after class and like you started like an indie squad.
Before UCB even, I was on a team at University of Arizona, a short form team called the Charles Darwin Experience.
Okay.
That was the very first improv team I was ever on. I don't know what my role was on there. It was so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was short form. It's just kind of like there's less roles. I think.
Oh, 100%. My first team was also a short form team back in college. Yeah.
What was it called?
Desperate for Attention.
Desperate for Attention.
But the four was a four.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What school?
Pacific Union College in Northern California.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which you were the Del Close of, I heard.
And what that is referencing is that I had bought the UCB manual and tried to teach the Herald to my short form team.
Oh, that's really cool. How'd it work?
It did not.
It did not. Yeah.
Did you guys ever try to experiment with long form?
So I was on that team, and my goal was going to be, because I was about to be the director of the team.
Same, yeah.
And then I got cut from the BFA acting program at the University of Arizona.
How does that work? Like, what
it's a probationary program. So your first and second year, you can be cut from it.
Was it because of grades?
No, no. Talent, I guess, or lack of talent. Yeah, they just like, if they feel like you don't fit into the program or that you're not a good actor or whatever.
So then what kind of people were the fit, and then what made you different?
I don't know, honestly. The people that were the fit were all, it was a really especially good musical theater program there.
I can't see you doing that.
Like, no, I suck at musical theater. Yeah. I can't sing. And the actors, I don't know. It was like any BFA program. Like, they were all pretty good friends of mine, like cool people. And also like really serious about acting, but like fun to party with. Like, I couldn't really define them in any way as big, different for me in a big way. I would say that I like had very little respect for my teachers, and that might have shown there.
Yeah, so like they're just like, this guy's not really interested in it.
It might have shown a little bit, but my goal, if I hadn't been, was to start doing long form on that group.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to USC for my last 2 years of college,
I didn't know you went to USC.
Yeah, I did 2 years there.
Okay,
and I was on a group there called Second Nature, and that was a long form group that like we took workshops with UCB teachers. We'd like tried to do Harold's. We like did like an hour long form show.
I read in your bio, and I'm not sure if this is true, that you didn't finish college or
I didn't graduate. I finished, but I'm missing a foreign language credit.
I'm missing a religion credit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's really, yeah. It was one of those things where it's like, it's never going to affect my career.
Never.
My parents got to saw me walk, which is all that matters.
My parents also got to see me walk.
So it's like, who cares? because I transferred from the U of A and USC didn't accept almost any of my credits.
Wow.
So I had to retake a ton of like gen ed classes. I just realized, like, who cares about this? But
no, I promise you, I got a plan.
Great. It will leave. And then, like, by the time it was time to graduate, I just like didn't get my extra foreign language credit. I had taken a Hebrew class at U of A and not at USC.
Yeah, what happened with me is like I walked and then like I kind of like had like a champagne hangover where I was just like, I did it. Like, why do I have to take this class? So I just kind of moved here instead.
You were like, were you signed up for summer school?
Or? I was, and I just didn't go to the class. Yeah.
I'm going to go to LA and just take a bunch of improv classes instead.
So then, was that kind of like what happened? What year did you graduate college?
2009.
Okay. And that's also when you started UCB.
Yeah.
So, UCB was relatively new to LA at the time, right? Had just shown up in 2007, I think.
Maybe a little earlier.
No, like 2015.
But yeah. I think it had been around for like 4 or 5 years at least by then.
So like, who are in your classes at the top? Like, as anyone that you're just like, whoa. Like,
Jacob Reed, who's on Bangarang, and Justin Michael, who's on Winslow with me, we were all in the same class, on the same group in college.
Oh, okay.
At USC. In my classes, let's see, Michaela Pettigrew was in my 101.
Okay.
I remember her being very funny. She was from Sacramento at the time and was like, I think, here for the summer. I took a couple levels that were as like people I didn't know very well and really keep in touch with. And then my 401 with Joe Wenger, I had Jacob Womack was in it, Matt Newell. I'm sure other super funny people that I'm forgetting.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So then in class, because you had already been like taking all those improv workshops, were you kind of just like a go-getter? Like you were already like pretty hot on your heels, or did you like, were you kind of shy and making moves?
No, I was like shy in that I like kept to myself in class.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was probably a little cocky, not cocky, I would say, but like, I was learning stuff in class that I already knew.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
You know, and it was good to get the experience and like good to learn from different teachers. I was learning a ton. But there was also an element of like, you know, you're in class with a bunch of people learning something for the first time and you don't want to be like, fuck this, I know everything.
Yeah.
And have that attitude and like be in every scene. But I remember I had a couple teachers tell me like, you can get out more and like do more work. Like,
oh, okay.
You know what you're doing. You can kind of like lead the way a little more, which I like now that I'm a teacher, like I see where that mentality comes from, where you like, I know this person's good and they're either being polite or they're not confident yet.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, if you do well, it makes my job easier because I can point to what you did and be like, see, that's what it's supposed to happen.
And like, I always relate things back to basketball, but like, I remember specifically in high school, we had this guy who was really great at shooting threes, but he never would. And like, our coach was just like, you realize that you're just hurting our team, right? Yeah.
Like, you think you're being unselfish, but you're doing the meanest thing possible.
Yeah. Like, you're not scoring, so like, we're losing these games. We lost like 10 games by three last year.
All you had to do was shoot one three and we would have gone into overtime. Yeah, I totally, it's funny because I play basketball with a lot of people that do improv, and you can like see that same persona on stage that usually people play basketball like how they improvise, where it's like if they're a leader on stage and like unselfish, they're like that way on the court.
Yeah.
Or if they're like, you know, always kill and like always get the attention when they walk on stage, they're like a star on court too. Mm-hmm. It's like,
yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think
you can even see it at like parties and stuff too. Like they kind of like always fulfill that role. Like,
yeah.
So going back to that.
Role filling.
who do you think you are in improv? Like, what is, like...
I think for most of my improv career, I felt like the Herald has always made sense to me.
Mm.
And, like, that's not a... I never say that as, like, a cocky thing of, like, I get the Herald.
Yeah.
It's just like some people's brains, the Herald is made for a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And some people like it need a little more to like click or need to learn it differently than how UCB teaches.
Yeah.
Like for whatever reason, like the way UCB teaches like clicks with my brain, maybe because it was created by a bunch of like privileged straight white people and I'm a privileged straight white guy and we think the same way. But so I always felt like I was able to like see shows and moves and like, be like, oh, I know where this can go, or I know how to like solidify this game, or I know like what the audience is missing informationally that I can add here.
Yeah.
I
noticed that I watched your guys's I didn't really know much about you. I think I had seen you a lot because it went from interning and stuff like that. But my first interaction with you ever was Charlie Mihalik's Spank. That was I was saying show and then transition to saying spank. But that was like my first interaction with you. And interestingly enough, I've seen Winslow a lot and you were never there. You were never there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like it was last year when they first got Fuck, Marry, Kill.
At Franklin or here or at Sunset?
When it was at Sunset.
Okay.
And I had like seen them like four times.
And I just happened to
be
not
there.
That's
and
funny.
I was like, okay, and then someone's like, Dan Lippert's on Winslow. I was like, no, he's not. Like,
I don't remember missing that many. I guess you just went to all the ones I wasn't at.
Yeah, but yeah, I would see you a lot. I think like you were coaching Harold last year, so that's why I saw you a ton. And then so I saw you in the saw you at the Spank, and I was like, oh, I got to research this guy. So I watched Best of Winslow, and yeah, you do like add like a lot of information and like, you do kind of like seem to like know the game and kind of, at least in those clips, like kind of like add buttons and stuff like that. Like, do you find yourself doing that a lot? Or
yeah, I think so. Yeah. Not actively, but like, yeah.
Like you see, like you don't have to like talk a lot in scenes because you see like the whole map of it and you're like, I know like where I'm going to like make this move here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily like see ahead or like have the whole map.
Mm-hmm.
I have always found that I am like not. There are people whose role that like I'm jealous of and love, who are able to be funny no matter what the situation is.
Okay,
they don't have to know the game. Like they don't have to know
like a Carl Tart.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
He's gonna walk on and say something, and it's gonna be funny, and it's not even gonna distract from the scene.
No,
it will. He'll just be like naturally funny.
Yeah,
and that's not a skill I have.
Yeah,
so I try to talk less, so that because I feel the pressure to be funny when I'm talking. You
yeah,
know?
Absolutely.
And so like I find the more I talk, the less I say, and the less funny I am.
Yeah,
maybe. So it's more just like reacting.
Okay.
I am at my best when I'm just like reacting and listening.
Okay. All right. So tell me about your first indie team, and did you kind of make that discovery about yourself on that indie team? And what were you guys like?
I don't think I was super like self-analytical early on about like what my role was. The first group I really practiced with, Drew DeFonso Marks coached us, and it was like, I think Zach Reno was on it, and I can't remember who else. But then from that group, Zach was like, hey, I want to start another group that practices. And it was me, him, Richie Root, Dan Foster, and Tim Simons, that five people. And we were called the Legends of Country Music.
That's a super stacked team.
It's a great team. It was really fun. It was crazy looking back. We practiced from 10 to midnight at USC because it was the only I could get us a room there. Like none of us lived in a place, and I knew like what would be open. It was after I graduated. And thinking back, I'm like, fuck, man, it was so nice of Berg to come down there and like coach us. I would never do that now. It's so late. It's such a drive.
And yeah,
but we practiced the Pretty Flower. Like we were like, we wanted to learn a form. And so Berg coached us on the Pretty Flower. And I don't think we were ever that good at it, but it was like a really fun group.
Mm-hmm.
My role on that, I don't know. I think we all kind of filled the same role, like, because that's such a collaborative form.
It really much so is. Yeah.
If anyone's controlling it, you can tell.
Yeah.
And I think we all trusted each other enough, or just like we're at the same experience level, that like nobody would wanted to try to control it. I think all my early indie groups, I would not say that I had a role. I think they all, like, this was around the time where you performed with an indie group like once every 3 months, maybe.
Yeah. That's very different than how it is now. Yeah.
If you got a show, it was like a big deal, and you would just kind of like have fun and like buckle down.
Mm.
But it would be hard to like maybe develop a voice as an indie group as much.
So I guess that's a plus in like the big amount of shows now. But the downside of it, though, is that like there's so many shows.
Yeah. And there's like a lack of focus. If I coach an indie group, I always tell them, because like Besser said this after a workshop once, and I was like, this is very true and inspiring, but it was like, if you're doing indie stuff, like don't treat it like a fuck around for your friends. Yep. Treat it like a real show.
I said the same exact words.
Come
in the
last
one. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like come in and have a focus. Be like, all right, let's in this show work on acting. Or is this exactly what you said?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. Yeah.
And so like, if you have that mentality, I think the indie scene is great. But if the mentality is like, it's just a place to make friends and have fun, that's great too.
Yeah.
But it won't make you good at the Herald or whatever your goal
You're doing
is.
The same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And
it's like if you wanted to play basketball, but you only practiced with like the And One mixtape guys.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure those guys, if they ever played a real NBA team, would get their asses rocked.
Absolutely. I think Rafer Alston is like the only one who successfully transferred over.
Is is he the professor?
Was he the
I don't remember.
I don't think
that's
so.
The only Ray thing for, I remember.
He played for the Magic in that one series where like they almost won it
all. When they had Shaq and Penny?
No.
More recently.
When it was Dwight versus Kobe.
Oh, yeah.
That one. Yeah. And then I think like Stan Van Gundy, like when he got like they had Rafer as their starting point guard throughout the entire playoffs, and then and the NBA Finals, Jameel Nelson like had healed up, and then Stan Van Gundy's like, "Oh, I'm going to start Jameel Nelson instead," and that kind of like ruined their chemistry. Also, the Lakers back then were like fucking killer.
Yeah,
so they lost that series.
That was the Shaq Kobe Lakers.
No, it's Kobe and Pa.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
Pa, not Pau.
Pau, I guess. Pau makes more sense.
Matter.
Pa Gasol.
I think that it is like role wise early on in the indie scene. I was so focused on myself, just like figuring out what I was doing or whatever, that I wasn't as aware of my roles now as I might be like now on Herald teams or anything like that.
So then, how long was it between that first team towards like your Herald auditions? Like how many Herald auditions did it take you to?
I auditioned once.
Okay.
I always say that with the caveat of like I was in my 401 and I graduated 2 weeks after an audition. And so I couldn't audition that year. And okay. so I had like a full year from there to take. Like,
I had the same. I had the same experience.
We're the same person.
Yeah.
This is like so I had like a lot of time in that year to kind of keep working on stuff. And like, I think if I had auditioned at right after that 401, like when I was just about to graduate, I wouldn't have made a team.
Yeah.
So, but that was 2011. That was my first audition, for, mm-hmm. and that's when Winslow happened.
So you've been on Winslow the whole time.
Yeah.
Did that make it a lot easier to kind of like figure out how you fit into the team? I mean, I can only imagine. So.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's like, I think the thing of like how you fit in the roles thing is like your first year. It's everybody's just figuring it out, and you're kind of like realizing what someone does that can make you laugh, and you're not even aware of it. Mm-hmm. But if someone's like introduces like crazy grandma, everyone knows it's like, okay, this is going to be Drew walking on his crazy grandma.
Yeah.
Like you can kind of like be aware, like, oh, this scene needs a voice of reason. We know basically who's going to do that.
Yeah.
Whether or not you're actively thinking it, it's like how you start to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so then after that first year, I think it then starts to become destructive because you start to only play your role.
You start to limit yourself.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I won't come in as crazy grandma because someone Drew's going to do it better than me or whatever. And so you stop doing – or like, I'm not going to edit this scene because X, Y, or Z person always has the edits down.
Yeah.
And so everybody stops challenging themselves and kind of you start to get into like a little bit of a pattern. It's probably like being married for a few years where mm-hmm. it's like if you don't purposefully make it exciting, it
you have to
like,
make that effort.
Yeah, you got to make the effort.
So then should the kind of like the idea change from roles to kind of like goals? Like so like instead it's just like you figure out this thing like, all right, now I'm good at this. Then now you kind of walk away from it and then challenge yourself to be the crazy grandma. Like, find out why do I not feel comfortable doing the crazy grandma, and then go out and challenge yourself and try it.
I think so, yeah. And it's like, it's hard. My thing has always been that I am never aware of how I'm being perceived.
Mm.
And I think, like, in my opinion, and people I'm sure will differ, but, like, that's a big job as a coach, like, of a team, is to, like, quietly be aware of, like, how people are being perceived and whether or not they're aware of it
mm-hmm.
and start pushing them away from that. Of, like, it seems like you are always the last one on in group games because you feel like you need to control them. And I'm not saying you, Edgar. I'm saying, like, the
Now I'm the first person in on group games. I wasn't.
Or, like, you know, you always, like, you'll never jump in with everything. And so it's, like, pushing that person to be, like, hey, be the second one out. Be the first one out and just jump into it and, like, be comfortable with the chaos and let someone else control it, which I think it was my thing was, like, I always felt like Winslow is allowed to get crazy. And then I will kind of be like, okay, let's gather together again.
We are very similar.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it is really helpful and like groups need it. But it's also like if you put yourself into that role, then you don't get to you put yourself above the show or separate from the show.
Yes.
Instead of being like, well, we'll all go crazy and I'll someone in the group will figure it out. It doesn't have to be me every time. And if not, we'll learn the lesson and get the note that no one figured it out. And next time around, people will be more aware of it or whatever.
And I think that kind of like takes pressure off of yourself. Cause I know like, I don't feel that with DiCaprio so much, but with Arcade Currency, like they'll all kind of get crazy. And then like, I'll put so much pressure on myself to figure it out. And when I don't, I blame myself for like the entire set, which is just like, it's unfair. Like there's six other people improvising and doing things. And then, sometimes it could be anything else. Like that's not necessarily why it didn't work out, you know, like there's so many other reasons and stuff like that.
Well, it's, probably, I would guess because it's my problem, I would bet it might be yours too. And like life relationships mm-hmm. where it's like, you take all of the onus on the success or failure of it on yourself.
Oh, 100%.
And it's, and you try to control how someone else responds to you.
Yep.
And then it's destructive because then like you don't get to be your own self because you're so busy worried about being the right version of whatever thing is and not ruining it or being there to like fix it when shit goes down.
When's your birthday, Dan?
November 5th.
Okay, cool. It's not a horoscope thing.
Did you think we were going to be
horoscope
dudes? When's yours?
May 20th.
May 20th. Happy birthday in 2 months.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, and I think like it is, it affects comedy too because you start to be that like trying that overly aware of how your group or the people around you are responding to you. Mm-hmm. Also affects being too aware of how the audience is responding to
exactly.
you and trying to control how they perceive you.
So you're no longer in it.
Yeah. It's like, I can't do this crazy move because what if the audience, like I embarrass myself or like it's an inability to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like is a good thing to be aware of and try to overcome.
Yeah.
In like those small ways.
So now I want to switch to talking about your sketch team. Big Grande.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted this part to be a little bit more, I guess, like behind the scenes of it.
Sure.
And kind of like talk about something that I really liked about Birthday Boys, and not to compare you guys to them, but I'm talking more about like the behind the scenes part of them. I tweeted at them one time and I was just like, why are there some of you guys who are in sketches more on your show and some of you guys who aren't in any of the sketches? And the response that I got back was, well, we all like do different things for the team, and some of us direct more of the sketches, and some of us are actors in the sketches. So, like on Big Grande, are there really like clear cut roles? Like, is there someone who's writing a lot of the sketches? Is there someone who usually just acts and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Is there someone who edits? Like, just so like I feel like a lot of times sketch teams fall apart because they get 7 actors,
right.
And they're like, we'd be really funny. And then the sketches are bad because they're all 7 actors.
There's no focus.
There's no focus. Yeah. There's no division of duties.
I think the greatest part of Big Grande and the reason it might take us a long time or will never happen that we become like commercially successful is that we don't want to define those roles too much.
Mm.
I think like we all want to contribute equally. And like our process is relatively slow because everyone will go off and write their own sketch and
yeah.
then bring it in. And then we'll basically rewrite it word for word as a group. Like we'll like take the basic game or fun thing or sometimes something like totally different that like tickled us and we'll like improvise it together and rewrite it line by line, and basically like most of our roles are involved with like while we're hanging out and talking about something,
mm-hmm.
what like gut makes us laugh.
Yeah.
And if something doesn't like hit us in the gut and make us like start like crying laughing, we probably won't do it. Beyond that, I mean, John is like a really talented director and editor, and he's good with the camera, so he fits into that role. He does all of our like any sort of posters. He's willing to do that, which is a big game.
Yeah.
And also he's
that was my guess, was that he was the one who like directs.
Yeah, like, he liked as far as stage stuff, we all kind of direct each
yeah,
other,
but like
wherever
video,
shooting anything,
yeah.
He's doing most of the like technical and creative work. But even in that process, I mean, like when we're sitting down to edit a sketch, like he'll do a rough cut and then we'll all sit and we'll go through the
exactly.
whole thing and look at different takes, and like it takes forever and it can be frustrating, but it's also like why our fingerprints like as a group are all over every product. And like what it does is it get like I'm so aware of that group's voice and what
exactly.
we like.
That's the point I was gonna make.
And I'm totally not aware of my own voice as a writer. Like mm-hmm. I write for Big Grande, which is the only thing that's fun for me.
Yeah. And I think that like it makes you guys so much of a stronger voice, right? Like it never really, I mean, that's kind of what you want, is for someone to watch it and be like, that's Big Grande, then someone to watch and be like, that's Dan Lippert. Like, you know, like
yeah.
you want that kind of uniformity, and that's job security. Like, you know, like that makes you guys valuable as a unit. How do you think sketch teams, especially younger sketch teams, can get to that? Is it everyone committing to like always being a part of everything, or?
That's a good question. I mean, the hardest part of everything would be to all like each other for a long time. I feel like a lot of times people get together out of convenience.
Okay.
And it's like, well, you like to write and I like to write and we both need something. And I think that's great to start. And if you click, great. But if you don't, like, feel free to move on.
Mm.
I think we got really lucky that, like, we all really liked each other. We were all developing. You want to work with someone that's at your level. Like, we're all developing the same types of skills around the same time.
Yeah.
But, like, my advice, if they wanted to stick together, I would really say, like, do a ton of improv together.
Okay. So don't start at sketch.
For me, yeah, because, like, we only started doing sketch because I don't even know why we started doing sketch, to be honest. I think at some point it's just, like, the obvious next step. It's like you're not going to get an improv show at the theater when you're not on a team yet there even.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you make your voice heard? Well, you write stuff. But we started doing improv together, basically, and then started to – and had a ton of fun. And then started writing, and our first sketch show happened to go well. So we kept working together. I'm trying to think of how to answer that question.
I think you're answering it.
Getting a group together. I would say, like, it's hard because some people don't like to improvise and they do want to write. But it's, like, improvise with a lot of different people a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And, like, you're going to have that person who, like – like, Ryan Rosenberg and I will always talk about the first time we did a show together. We just clicked on this scene where someone, like, had switched out a baby with a KFC meal. and, like, somehow the scene ended up where we were in a giant KFC bucket driving it like the Flintstones.
Uh-huh.
and, like, that was our thing of, like, oh, we have the same sense of humor. Like, this made us both laugh really hard. It was really stupid. And, like, you have that with a lot of people, I think. But at a certain point, it's like, should we try to start writing together?
And it gets more and more defined, right?
Like, yeah.
It's
a broad thing, and then it's like, oh, shit, we laugh really hard at just saying a word weird. And it's like, great, like, that's going to affect us. And you never really talk about your voice. You just start, like, seeing what's fun when you're hanging out.
I noticed that your guys' sketches are kind of like, it's like a dumb thing, but no one ever really highlights that that thing is dumb, if that makes sense. Like, I think about, like, the Queen sketch, where it's a sketch where everyone's yelling, where he realizes that he didn't get to go to a party.
Yeah.
And, like, there's not really, like, a voice of reason in that sketch. Like, all of you guys are kind of weird in that sketch.
I think as far as roles go, that leads into, like, we all want to be funny in every sketch.
Yeah.
You know? I guess that sounds selfish. I would say it's not selfishly. It's just, like, you know, it's you see other people having fun and it's hard to not do it.
Yeah.
So usually if one of us brings in a sketch where it's one unusual character, it turns into everybody playing the game.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that is just for us, it's like, for the most part, it is so unfun to play the voice of reason in sketch a lot of the time.
It really much so is.
If you can do the sketch where you're just, like, hard yesing stuff and creating pattern and having fun with each other that way, why not, I think? But then, like, some of our more successful sketches, like, only do have one unusual character, I think.
Are you thinking, like the one that was on the UCB show?
Which one? Oh, that's the
one where you are clearly sick, but insist that you only have allergies.
Yeah, but even that one ends with all of us
all
in a wheelchair.
Guys, yeah.
but yeah, like that, I wasn't even thinking of that one. But there are some that are like, it's, I don't know, it's just one of us being fucking nuts and the other ones. Like, we have an optometrist sketch where Ryan is just showing me crazy pictures as the optometrist. And that one, it is really fun, but it took me a while as the voice of reason in that sketch, like, live and in other sketches, to realize that, like, your lines aren't supposed to get laughs, so you shouldn't be bummed if they don't.
Yeah.
Like, your goal, it can get laughs. Calling stuff out definitely can get laughs, but your goal should be just to set up the world and the reality so that this unusual character gets the laughs.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to, like, you know, kind of see that that's how you're servicing the scene. Like, you know, like, what's it? Sean Diston one time said that someone else had told him, so whatever. I don't even know why I have to go into all the quotes, but, like, he was saying that sometimes the best thing that you can do in a scene is be boring.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can add so much context to a scene by just being that person. But it's hard to, like, you know, realize that you affect the game. I think of something that I see specific, something that makes me think of that is on Sunday when the Warriors were playing the Knicks. I was going to bring it back to basketball.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Kerr was, like, showing.
I saw that clip.
Yeah, when he showed Steph Curry his stat sheet. And he's just like, your shooting might be terrible, but look at your plus minus.
Yeah,
like,
when you're on the court, we're still scoring way more points overall.
Yeah, like you still affect it. But it's hard to, especially for someone like Steph Curry, who is so used to affecting the game by just putting on a fantastic display of offense.
Yeah.
It's hard to realize that you still have that effect.
Yeah, like that being like aware of being just a role player on a team is like such a skill.
Yeah.
Because it is like so satisfying to be a part of a really good show.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's generally more satisfying than being the funniest part of a show.
100%.
Like, I honestly, like, I have left shows where, like, I felt like my character was, like, having the most fun of any of them and, like, was getting the best response. Like, everyone has that all the time at some point or another. And I leave those shows feeling guilty every time.
Yeah.
I always, like, apologize. Yep. Like, if I kill on my own, like, just based on my unusual character, I'll go off stage and be like, sorry about that, guys. Like, I should have asked you more about your character. We should have, like, endowed your character a little more.
Yeah.
Because I'm not comfortable in that position.
I think it makes me think of, like, I play a lot of NBA 2K, and they always, like, they have, like, that stock, like, TV analysis in it.
Yeah.
And one term they always bring up is glue guy, and I've become obsessed with that term. And I've been trying to, like, find the glue guys on not only basketball teams but, like, improv teams. And they're, like, the people who you don't notice it, but if you took that person out of that team, the whole team would fall apart.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, like, I've become obsessed with that for some reason. And, like, Draymond Green on the Warriors, where we saw it last year. He got suspended. And, like, people always, like, thought of Draymond as, like, inconsequential to the Warriors. Like, he's just their thug. But you took him away from that team, and they just collapsed because there's something that he brings to it that makes
them
all
kind of. He's, like, the fire and the energy and, like, you know, whatever comfort they get from having,
like,
that.
How, I don't know, like, I guess my question is, like, how do you make that kind of effort sexy in improv as a coach and as a teacher?
Yeah, I think it's the only real way to do it is to, A, point to people who do it, like, go watch the show and watch it happen, and you'll see it work. And B, it takes, like, a ton of work through practicing, through doing, like, dramatic scene work a little bit. Through, like for challenging people to be silent on stage longer.
Yeah.
Stuff like that where they do it, and the first time they do it, it gets, like, the biggest laugh they've gotten. And it's and they you feel it, and you can point to it and be like, you see, like, it does work.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you look at, like, Zach Woods, who is also inherently just fucking funny and interesting to watch and, like, a talented actor.
Yeah.
But, like, Drew Tarver and I were talking about this after a show the other night. He's basically, like, he's like steroids for a scene because you initiate as unusual, but you don't know where the scene's going. And he plays the glue guy by crystallizing it. Mm-hmm. In a very specific way.
Yeah.
Emotionally caring about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, adding information and just being interested and affected in the moment. And, like, all of those things are the basic things we learn. None of them are jokes. And but they're the hardest thing to keep doing. And he's killing.
Yeah.
Like, the audiences love it. They respond to it. Joe Wenger, like, does stuff like that.
Yeah, it's so, I think that you're right, is, like, kind of just pushing people to just kind of see that it does work. Because, like, you know, when you focus on, like, jokes and funny things like that, your brain almost tells you, like, why would I go back to being in a date in this scene? I'm not going to get laughs that way.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get laughs asking her what she wants to order and stuff like. But you will get to something more naturally funny, and, like, you add so much context to the scene that gives people information to play with, but it's hard to untrain your brain to, like, realize those kind of patterns and stuff like that.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you can't blame anybody. You're on stage in front of 100 people,
yeah.
And you've come out, and they've all come out, and you've said, the premise of tonight is I'm going to make you laugh.
Yeah.
And it's like you feel that pressure and that energy, and it feels fucking good to get a laugh just by saying something funny. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like – but it's – you know, it's like doing drugs instead of working out,
yeah.
You know, where it's like – yeah, every hit, like, you'll immediately feel pretty good. But then you need, like, a bigger hit or a stronger drug on and on. Whereas if you work out, you'll kind of feel base level good all the time.
Yeah.
And, like, the highs are better when they happen, and they're more satisfying and they feel more earned.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very strong analogy.
Hey there, long-form listeners. UCB's Matt Walsh here. If you love learning about long-form improv, then you should check out the show I host with Scott Armstrong, UCB Sports and Leisure. Each episode is an improvised radio play featuring some of improv's finest, like John Gabris, Will Hines, Ego Wodum, Brad Morris, Horatio Sands, and more. You can subscribe to the UCB Sports and Leisure podcast on iTunes, and be sure to check out all our other great podcasts on iTunes.com/UCB Comedy. Peace.
Hey, improv fans, if the suggestion for your next show is beer, maybe initiate your scene with something like, check it out, they've got Bronx beer on tap at this bar. It's the start of a great scene, and ordering a Bronx is a great way to start any night out. And Bronx is now the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for more information, and be sure to make your next pint a Bronx. And scene.
So let's talk about Winslow. Now more so than when you guys were on Harold, do you kind of feel like, and this is something that I was talking to Andrew about from Cardinal Redbird, do you feel like your improv has changed since you've been off of Harold Night, and in what way? Because you guys got off of Harold Night when I started interning, I think.
Okay.
When did you guys get off?
Yeah, that sounds about right. 2 years ago.
Yeah, so that's right when I started interning at UCB.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it naturally changes because, I mean, like, doing the Herald is so specific.
Very.
It's like you have like a very specific goal, and focus, and you have a coach every time telling you kind of how you did towards that goal and towards that focus. And a lot of what we got pushed towards our last couple of years of Winslow was this feeling of like, hey, you all are individually fucking funny people. Like, let's see Winslow create more comedy, like, as a group. And not be all just individually good, but be, like, good as a group and work towards that. And once you are performing without a coach for audiences that don't care about the Herald, they just want to see a good show, that the other things are getting rewarded. Like, you're getting rewarded for, like, fucking right away.
Or yeah.
Like, which I guess you are at Herald Night, too. but it's like... You never see the downside of going hard and fast at one joke to a big extreme because you don't have to revisit it again if you don't want to.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference, is like the whole point of the Herald is like you set up a grounded, believable world and a strong comedic idea so that you can revisit it later and it'll still be as strong and make as much sense. But in a show like where you're like, what, this is going to be a 3-minute scene, let's blow it out to its craziest extremes and then say goodbye. And so it'll obviously be kind of like a different, not obviously, but it'll end up being a different focus. Overall is just like, great, did we take that idea to its fullest extent and
yeah.
do it in a way that like challenged ourselves?
How do you personally feel like your improv has changed? And like going back like to like the role thing, like do you find yourself doing more in scenes now or doing like especially going back to like that idea that you had that like you kind of like can see the game and kind of see like do you find yourself jumping out more? Are you playing the crazy grandma more?
I still don't do that crazy grandma as much. What I try to do more is be active rather than a reactive performer. And so like I pointed this out in your guys' notes last night because I'm hyper aware of it because it's what I used to be like. Is when you end up being voice of reason a lot of the time, or like kind of, if you feel like good about the form of improv, you kind of end up in that position of voice of reason more than unusual character.
Yep.
Which is great and it's important, but again, it's that lack of vulnerability in what you're playing and lack of losing control. And so instead of creating information, you're reacting to information in a comedic way. And so I've tried to push myself to create more information.
Do you think that you kind of do it because it's easier? Like, is that like, because you're a logical person and you like understand it, you're just like, oh, it would be easier to work in this scene. Is that why?
It's my comfort zone.
Yeah.
I know where I can get laughs and be successful and not be nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a position of like power in the scene.
Yeah.
So that's where I like naturally find myself. I don't go in thinking that's what I'm going to do, but if there's a thing where the idea is like, I'll give you a pretty good example of this is, like I was in a scene where, I got labeled as a guy by Will Hines who was driving a giant marijuana cigarette, based off of like a monologue, of someone who got pulled over and they rolled their window down and like they were super high and a bunch of weed smoke came out.
Yeah.
So he initiated as a cop pulling me over in a giant joint. And I like really struggled because usually my position would have been his position in that scene. I like really struggled to just add information, and be specific in that scene.
Yeah.
Which like I left being like, that scene could have been so fucking fun. That's such a fun idea. And I was like kicking myself on that.
So, because, like, now I'm thinking, like, what information would I add? And I'm also coming to, like, a blank and stuff like that.
Yeah, like, and the thing is, like, I don't know exactly what I could have added, but I could have just
lived in it
more instead of been, like, in my head about, like, oh, that's a crazy thing to be doing. What? Why would I be doing this right now? Whatever. Instead, just being like, yeah, man, it's a joint. What's up? Like, and, like, living that character.
Yeah, that simplicity is, like, it's just... It feels, again, like in your mind, you're just like, it can't be that easy. But
yeah.
It is. Like, it can be.
Yeah, most of the people who are, like, really good improvisers are just good actors who have spent a lot of time learning improv.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And something that I should learn, because I curse acting every day.
Like, you curse acting?
I say something bad about it every day.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
Why is that?
I just, like, I don't know. Like, in my mind, like... I don't look at acting. I don't know. This is going to sound really shitty. But, like, my heroes aren't actors. Like, the people that I, like, am obsessed with are, like, people like Dan Harmon or Sorkin or David Simon. Like, you know, like, like creators. Like, but that's not fair because, like, I think that actors are also creators. But it takes me a long time to, like, get away from wrestling with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think if you think of acting as just, like, for you, like, being emotionally truthful and vulnerable based on the situation you're in, then it's nothing beyond that.
Yeah.
It's just, like, for the longest time, you know, because you think of, like, the great actors would be, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman or something. Like, you can create a different character all the time.
He's a beast.
But, like, a good skill to have, maybe still is somewhere out there.
Yeah.
a good skill to have is just to be able to, like, especially for people our age, it's like you're not going to get cast right now as like some asshole 65-year-old senator.
Yeah.
So that's not a role you have to get worried about playing, but you will get cast as someone your age going through some sort of like struggles that you might not be aware of. But the goal is just to be able to live in that moment as like truthfully to like listening and being vulnerable and being able to like feel it.
Yeah, that's a really good note. And that's kind of like one of the first notes I got on Harold was like from Marcy, where she was just like, I feel like Edgar the writer is okay. I want to work more on like Edgar the actor. Like, I want to work more on like just like being in scenes and like being vulnerable and stuff like that.
Have you taken an acting class?
I haven't.
Are you super comfortable? Were you always comfortable in improv classes? Like, did you ever feel out of place or like you were?
I felt out of place more so. I mean, I always feel like a fraud.
Dude.
Well, I feel more so out of place when we do more of the acting stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's a good reason to take an acting class.
True.
Is to be in that position of like discomfort and vulnerability and like around people who are judging you for something that you're not sure you're good at.
Yeah.
Is like really scary. And
that's how I feel at auditions all the time.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
so like the more you do that, the more you'll become comfortable with it. The same way as like you're more comfortable in front of an audience after your 50th show than you were after your first show. Like, true. You can manipulate them and play against them and stuff.
So to kind of wrap things up, I have this question that might be hard to answer, but kind of like based off of that thing that Marcy told me. What is a note that you felt like you got earlier on that you think you successfully applied, and how?
That's a good question. What's a note you felt like you got early on that you felt like successfully applied, and how?
And who gave you the note? And how angry were they when they gave you?
You know, I rarely got personal notes. Mm. I think, like, a lot of people don't believe in them, or, like, don't think they're necessary, or just don't do it. And I think, like, because of the way the UCB structure is set up, the fact that I was – all right at the Herald and knew it meant I was getting like the least notes in a class or
yeah,
whatever.
Absolutely.
So I always was like hungry for like that to happen. And really like one of the only times that I can remember that someone did that, I got two from Eugene Cordero, and I'll say them both. One was like, he talked a lot about roles actually.
Yeah.
Most of like my thing about roles comes from him. But one was, I used to do this thing in Winslow practices where every time we finished the pattern game, I would edit by running across and pretending to kick Mono in the dick. And, like, it was just stupid and pointless. And he was like, I want to see that version of you on stage.
Mm.
Or it was like, I want to see the guy who, like, for no reason just kicks someone in the dick.
Yeah.
And so, like, that is what I'm still working on, but it's, like, the thing that stuck with me for a while.
Being a lot more carefree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the second, which is a big focus of mine now as a coach, was he was like, you know why something you do is funny, but you have to let the audience in sometimes. You can't just make the funny thing, do the funny thing and move past it. You got to like really like let them in and like take them on that walk of the joke or whatever it is that you like, rather than like just dropping it and leaving it.
Those are two great, great notes. I hope anyone who is listening wrote those down.
Or rewind if you don't want to write it down.
Yeah.
Press record.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's one that you got? Can I ask you?
Yeah.
Did you answer this already?
Yeah.
Just listen to a different episode?
They can, but I'll say it again. For me, what it was from Johnny Meek's Por Las Buenas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like that one. Like, that's like just like seeking the pleasure in scenes and like, you know, that one. And then another one also from Ronnie Adrian, which was like, care more as the voice of reason. Like, uh-huh. Don't like shit on someone as the voice of reason. Like, find ways to be empathetic with the unusual person more so than just being like, you're crazy for doing this bad thing. So those are two, like,
both again, yours were empathy based.
Yeah, I'm not a very, I think something that I'm learning about myself, sorry, Cody, something that I'm learning about myself is because I am so logic heavy, like, I tend to like just say things, they come off so like calculated and cold mm-hmm. that it just hurts the people around me. So, like, I'm learning. I'm a robot. I'm learning to, like, care and have feelings and stuff like that. And
it's
be vulnerable.
Yeah. It's because sometimes lack of empathy is rewarded with laughs.
It is.
Know? But then actually being empathetic is rewarded way more.
Way more.
Yeah. Like, being an asshole gets the first laugh, but not the last laugh.
No. That's true.
Mr. President.
And that was Long Form Conversation. Tune into the next episode when Dan Lippert will be your host. Thank you, Dan, for coming on and talking.
Thanks. I'm glad I got to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And sayonara.
Sayonara.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.
Thanks to the Bronx Brewery, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network, for their support. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for more information on all their craft beer. And be sure to make your next pint a Bronx.